sailor. He was meant to die at sea.
The gods beneath the waters have been waiting for me, he told himself. It's past time I went to them.
But now there was a sail, only a speck on the horizon, but growing larger.
A ship where no ship should be.
He knew where his rock lay, more or less. It was one of a series of sea months that rose from the floor of Blackwater Bay. The tallest of them jutted 100 feet above the tide, and a dozen lesser months stood 30 to 60 feet high. Sailors called them Spears of the Merlin King, and he knew that for every one that broke the surface, a dozen lurked treacherously just below it. Any captain with any sense kept his course well away from them. Davis watched the sail swell through pale red-rimmed eyes and tried to hear the sound of the wind caught in the canvas.
She's coming this way.
Unless she changed course soon, she would pass within hailing distance of his meagre refuge. It might mean life, if he wanted it. He was not sure he did.
Why should I live?
He thought as tears blurred his vision.
Gods be good, why? My sons are dead. Dale and Ellard, Merrick, and Mathis, perhaps Devon as well. How can a father outlive so many strong young sons? How would I go on? I'm a hollow shell. The crab's dead. There's nothing left inside. Don't they know that?
They had sailed up the Blackwater Rush, flying the fiery heart of the Lord of Light. Davis and Black Betha had been in the second line of battle, between Dale's Wraith and Allard and Lady Maria. Merrick, his third-born, was Oarmaster on Fury, at the centre of the first line, while Mathis served as his father's second. Beneath the walls of the Red Keep, Stannis Baratheon's galleys had joined in battle with the boy king Joffrey's smaller fleet, and for a few moments the river had rung to the thrum of bowstrings and the crash of iron rams shattering oars and hulls alike. And then some vast beast had let out a roar, and green flames were all around them. Wildfire, Pyromancer's Piss, the Jade Demon. Mathis had been standing at his elbow on the deck of Black Betha when the ship seemed to lift from the water. Davis found himself in the river, flailing as the current took him and spun him around and around. Upstream, the flames had ripped at the sky 50 feet high. He had seen Black Betha afire and Fury and a dozen other ships. Had seen burning men leaping into the water to drown. Wraith and Lady Maria were gone, sunk or shattered, or vanished behind a veil of wildfire. And there was no time to look for them, because the mouth of the river was almost upon him, and across the mouth of the river the Lannisters had raised a great iron chain. From bank to bank there was nothing but burning ships and wildfire. The sight of it seemed to stop his heart for a moment, and he could still remember the sound of it, the crackle of flames, the hiss of steam, the shrieks of dying men, and the beat of that terrible heat against his face as the current swept him down toward hell. All he needed to do was nothing. A few moments more, and he would be with his sons now, resting in the cool green mud on the bottom of the bay, with fish nibbling at his face. Instead, he sucked in a great gulp of air and dove, kicking for the bottom of the river. His only hope was to pass under the chain and the burning ships and the wildfire that floated on the surface of the water to swim hard for the safety of the bay beyond. Davis had always been a strong swimmer, and he'd worn no steel that day, but for the helm he'd lost when he lost Black Betha. As he knifed through the green murk, he saw other men struggling beneath the water, pulled down to drown beneath the weight of plate and mail. Davis swam past them, kicking with all the strength left in his legs, giving himself up to the current, the water filling his eyes. Deeper he went, and deeper still. With every stroke it grew harder to hold his breath. He remembered seeing the bottom soft and dim as a stream of bubbles burst from his lips. Something touched his leg. A snag, or a fish, or a drowning man. He could not tell. He needed air by then, but he was afraid. Was he past the chain yet? Was he out in the bay? If he came up under a ship, he would drown. And if he surfaced amidst the floating patches of wildfire, his first breath would sear his lungs to ash. He twisted in the water to look up, but there was nothing to see but green darkness, and then he spun too far, and suddenly he could no longer tell up from down. Panic took hold of him. His hands flailed against the bottom of the river and sent up a cloud of mud that blinded him. His chest was growing tighter by the instant. He clawed at the water, kicking, pushing himself, turning, his lungs screaming for air, kicking, kicking, lost now in the river murk, kicking, 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 until he could kick no longer. When he opened his mouth to scream, the water came rushing in, tasting of salt, and Davis Seaworth knew that he was drowning. The next he knew, the sun was up, and he lay on a stony strand beneath a spire of naked stone, with the empty bay all around him, and a broken mast, a burned sail, and a swollen corpse beside him. The mast, the sail, and the dead man vanished with the next high tide, leaving Davis alone on his rock amidst the spears of the Merlin King. His long years as a smuggler had made the waters around King's Landing more familiar to him than any home he'd ever had, and he knew his refuge was no more than a speck on the charts, in a place that honest sailors steered away from, not toward. Though Davis himself had come by it once or twice in his smuggling days, the better to stay unseen.
"When they find me dead here, if ever they do, perhaps they will name the rock for me," he thought. "Onion Rock, they'll call it. It will be my tombstone and my legacy."
He deserved no more.
"The father protects his children," the septons taught.
But Davis had led his boys into the fire. Dale would never give his wife the child they had prayed for, and Allard, with his girl in Old Town, and his girl in King's Landing, and his girl in Bravos, they would all be weeping soon. Mathis would never captain his own ship as he dreamed. Marek would never have his knighthood.
"How can I live when they are dead? So many brave knights and mighty lords have died, better men than me, and I born. Crawl inside your cave, Davis. Crawl inside and shrink up small, and the ship will go away, and no one will trouble you ever again. Sleep on your stone pillow, and let the gulls peck out your eyes while the crabs feast on your flesh. You feasted on enough of them. You owe them. Hide, smuggler, hide, and be quiet and die."
The sail was almost on him. A few moments more, and the ship would be safely past, and he could die in peace. His hand reached for his throat, fumbling for the small leather pouch he always wore about his neck. Inside he kept the bones of the four fingers his king had shortened for him, on the day he made Davis a knight.
"My luck."
His shortened fingers patted at his chest, groping, finding nothing. The pouch was gone, and the finger bones with them. Stannis could never understand why he'd kept the bones.
"To remind me of my king's justice," he whispered through cracked lips.
But now they were gone.
"The fire took my luck as well as my son's."
In his dreams the river was still aflame, and demons danced upon the waters with fiery whips in their hands, while men blackened and burned beneath the lash.
"Mother, have mercy," Davis prayed. "Save me, gentle mother. Save us all. My luck is gone. And my sons."
He was weeping freely now, salt tears streaming down his cheeks.
"The fire took it all. The fire."
Perhaps it was only wind blowing against the rock or the sound of the sea on the shore. But for an instant, Davis Seaworth
heard her answer.
"You call the fire," she whispered, her voice as faint as the sound of waves in a seashell, sad and soft.
"You burned us. Burned us. Burned us."
"It was her," Davis cried. "Mother, don't forsake us. It was her who burned you, the red woman. Melisande, her."
He could see her. Her heart-shaped face, the red eyes, the long, coppery hair, the red gowns moving like flames as she walked. A swirl of silk and satin. She had come from Ashayi in the east. She had come to Dragonstone and won Selyse and her queen's men for her alien god. And then the king, Stannis Baratheon himself. He had gone so far as to put the fiery heart on his banners, the fiery heart of R'hllor, Lord of Light, and God of Flame and Shadow. At Melisande's urging, he had dragged the seven from their sceptred Dragonstone and burned them before the castle gates, and later had burned the godswood at Storm's End as well, even the heart tree, a huge white weirwood with a solemn face.
"It was her work," Davis said again, more weakly. "Her work and yours, Onion Knight. You rode her into Storm's End in the black of night, so she might loose her shadow child. You are not guiltless, no. You rode beneath her banner and flew it from your mast. You watched the seven burn at Dragonstone and did nothing. She gave the fathers justice to the fire, and the mothers mercy, and the wisdom of the crone, smith and stranger, maid and warrior. She burned them all to the glory of her cruel god, and you stood and held your tongue. Even when she killed old Maester Cresson, even then you did nothing."
The sail was 100 yards away and moving fast across the bay. In a few more moments it would be past him and dwindling. Sir Davos Seaworth began to climb his rock. He pulled himself up with trembling hands, his head swimming with fever. Twice his maimed fingers slipped on the damp stone and he almost fell, but somehow he managed to cling to his perch. If he fell, he was dead. And he had to live. For a little while more, at least. There was something he had to do. The top of the rock was too small to stand on safely, as weak as he was, so he crouched and waved his fleshless arms.
"Ship!"
he screamed into the wind.
"Ship here! Here!"
From up here, he could see her more clearly, the lean, striped hull, the bronze figurehead, the billowing sail. There was a name painted on her hull, but Davos had never learned to read.
"Ship!"
he called again.
"Help me! Help me!"
A crewman on her forecastle saw him and pointed. He watched as other sailors moved to the gunwale to gape at him. A short while later, the galley's sail came down. Her oars slid out, and she swept around towards his refuge. She was too big to approach the rock closely, but 30 yards away she launched a small boat. Davos clung to his rock and watched it creep toward him. 4 men were rowing, while a 5th sat in the prow.
"You!"
the 5th man called out, when they were only a few feet from his island.
"You, up on the rock! Who are you?"
"A smuggler who rose above himself," thought Davos. "A fool who loved his king too much and forgot his gods."
"I..."
His throat was parched, and he had forgotten how to talk. The words felt strange on his tongue and sounded stranger in his ears.
"I was in the battle. I was a captain, a knight. I was a knight."
"Aye, sir,"
the man said.
"And serving which king?"
The galley might be Joffrey's, he realized suddenly. If he spoke the wrong name now, she would abandon him to his fate. But no, her hull was striped. She was Lysine. She was Salador Sans. The mother sent her here. The mother in her mercy. She had a task for him.
Stannis lives, he knew then. I have a king still. And sons. I have other sons. And a wife loyal and loving.
How could he have forgotten? The mother was merciful indeed.
Stannis! He shouted back at the Lyseni. Gods be good! I serve King Stannis!
Aye, said the man in the boat.
And so do we.
John. There were times, not many, but a few, when John Snow was glad he was a bastard. As he filled his wine cup once more from a passing flagon, it struck him that this might be one of them. He settled back in his place on the bench among the younger squires and drank. The sweet, fruity taste of summer wine filled his mouth and brought a smile to his lips. The great hall of Winterfell was hazy with smoke and heavy with the smell of roasted meat and fresh-baked bread. Its grey stone walls were draped with banners, white, gold, crimson, the direwolf of Stark, Baratheon's crowned stag, the Lion of Lannister. A singer was playing the high harp and reciting a ballad, but down at this end of the hall his voice could scarcely be heard above the roar of the fire, the clangor of pewter plates and cups, and the low mutter of 100 drunken conversations. It was the fourth hour of the welcoming feast laid for the king. John's brothers and sisters had been seated with the royal children beneath the raised platform where Lord and Lady Stark hosted the king and queen. In honour of the occasion, his lord father would doubtless permit each child a glass of wine, but no more than that. Down here on the benches, there was no one to stop John drinking as much as he had a thirst for. And he was finding that he had a man's thirst, to the raucous delight of the youths around him, who urged him on every time he drained a glass. They were fine company, and John relished the stories they were telling, tales of battle and bedding and the hunt. He was certain that his companions were more entertaining than the king's offspring. He had sated his curiosity about the visitors when they had made their entrance. The procession had passed not a foot from the place he had been given on the bench, and John had gotten a good, long look at them all. His lord father had come first, escorting the queen. She was as beautiful as men said. A jewel tiara gleamed amidst her long golden hair, its emeralds a perfect match for the green of her eyes. His father helped her up the steps to the dais and led her to her seat. But the queen never so much as looked at him. Even at 14, John could see through her smile. Next had come King Robert himself, with Lady Stark in his arm. The king was a great disappointment to John. His father had talked of him often, the peerless Robert Baratheon, demon of the trident, the fiercest warrior of the realm, a giant among princes. John saw only a fat man, red-faced under his beard, sweating through his silks. He walked like a man half in his cups. After them came the children. Little Rickon first, managing the long walk with all the dignity a three-year-old could muster. John had to urge him on when he stopped to visit. Close behind came Rob, in grey wool trimmed with white, the Stark colours. He had the Princess Marcella on his arm. She was a wisp of a girl, not quite 8, her hair a cascade of golden curls under a jewelled net. John noticed the shy look she gave Rob as they passed between the tables, and the timid way she smiled at him. He decided she was insipid. Rob didn't even have the sense to realize how stupid she was. He was grinning like a fool. His half-sisters escorted the royal princes. Arya was paired with plump young Tommen, whose white blonde hair was longer than hers. Sansa, 2 years older, drew the crown prince, Joffrey Baratheon. He was 12, younger than John or Rob, but taller than either, to John's vast dismay. Prince Joffrey had his sister's hair and his mother's deep green eyes. A thick tangle of blonde curls dripped down past his golden choker and high velvet collar. Sansa looked radiant as she walked beside him. But John did not like Joffrey's pouty lips or the bored, disdainful way he looked at Winterfell's great hall. He was more interested in the pair that came behind him, the Queen's brothers, the Lannisters of Casterly Rock, the Lion and the Imp. There was no mistaking which was which. Sir Jaime Lannister was twin to Queen Cersei, tall and golden, with flashing green eyes and a smile that cut like a knife. He wore crimson silk, high black boots, a black satin cloak. On the breast of his tunic, the lion of his house was embroidered in gold thread, roaring its defiance. They called him the Lion of Lannister to his face and whispered, "Kingslayer," behind his back. John found it hard to look away from him. "This is what a king should look like," he thought to himself as the man passed. Then he saw the other one, waddling along, half hidden by his brother's side. Tyrion Lannister, the youngest of Lord Tywin's brood, and by far the ugliest. All that the guards had given to Cersei and Jaime, they had denied Tyrion. He was a dwarf, half his brother's height, struggling to keep pace on stunted legs. His head was too large for his body, with a brute's squashed-in face beneath a swollen shelf of brow. One green eye and one black one peered from under a lank fall of hair, so blond it seemed white. John watched him with fascination. The last of the High Lords to enter were his uncle, Benjen Stark, of the Night's Watch, and his father's ward, young Theon Greyjoy. Benjen gave John a warm smile as he went by. Theon ignored him utterly, but there was nothing new in that. After all had been seated, toasts were made. Thanks were given and returned, and then the feasting began. John had started drinking then, and he had not stopped. Something rubbed against his leg beneath the table. John saw red eyes staring up at him. "Hungry again?" he asked. There was still half a honey chicken in the centre of the table. John reached out to tear off a leg. Then he had a better idea. He knifed the bird whole and let the carcass slide to the floor between his legs. Ghost ripped into it in savage silence. His brothers and sisters had not been permitted to bring the old wolves to the banquet. But there were more curs than John could count at this end of the hall, and no one had said a word about his pup. He told himself he was fortunate in that too. His eyes stung. John rubbed at them savagely, cursing the smoke. He swallowed another gulp of wine and watched his dire wolf devour the chicken. Dogs moved between the tables, trailing after the serving girls. One of them, a black mongrel bitch with long yellow eyes, caught a scent of the chicken. She stopped and edged onto the bench to get a share. John watched the confrontation. The bitch growled low in her throat and moved closer. Ghost looked up, silent, and fixed the dog with those hot red eyes. The bitch snapped an angry challenge. She was three times the size of the dire wolf pup. Ghost did not move. He stood over his prize and opened his mouth, baring his fangs. The bitch tensed, barked again, then thought better of this fight. She turned and slunk away, with one last defiant snap to save her pride. Ghost went back to his meal. John grinned and reached under the table to ruffle the shaggy white fur. The direwolf looked up at him, nipped gently at his hand, then went back to eating. "Is this one of the direwolves I've heard so much about?" a familiar voice asked close at hand. John looked up happily as his Uncle Ben put a hand on his head and ruffled his hair, much as John had ruffled the wolf's. "Yes," he said, "his name is Ghost." One of the squires interrupted the bawdy story he'd been telling to make room at the table for their lord's brother. Benjen Stark straddled the bench with long legs and took the wine cup out of John's hand. "Summer wine," he said after a taste. "Nothing so sweet. How many cups have you had, John?" John smiled. Ben Stark laughed. "As I feared. Well, I believe I was younger than you the first time I got truly and sincerely drunk." He snagged a roasted onion, dripping brown with gravy, from a nearby trencher, and bit into it. It crunched. His uncle was sharp-featured and gaunt as a mountain crag, but there was always a hint of laughter in his blue-grey eyes. He dressed in black, as befitted a man of the night's watch. Tonight it was rich black velvet, with high leather boots and a wide belt with a silver buckle. A heavy silver chain was looped round his neck. Benjamin watched Ghost with amusement as he ate his onion. "A very quiet wolf," he observed. "He's not like the others," John said. "He never makes a sound. That's why I named him Ghost. That, and because he's white. The others are all dark, grey or black. There are still dire wolves beyond the wall. We hear them on our rangings." Benjamin Stark gave John a long look. "Don't you usually eat at table with your brothers?" "Most times," John answered in a flat voice, "but tonight Lady Stark thought it might give insult to the royal family to see a bastard among them."
"I see."
His uncle glanced over his shoulder at the raised table at the far end of the hall.
"My brother does not seem very festive tonight."
John had noticed that too. A bastard had to learn to notice things, to read the truth that people hid behind their eyes. His father was observing all the courtesies, but there was a tightness in him that John had seldom seen before. He said little, looking out over the hall with hooded eyes, seeing nothing. Two seats away, the king had been drinking heavily all night. His broad face was flushed behind his great black beard. He made many a toast, laughed loudly at every jest, and attacked each dish like a starving man. But beside him, the queen seemed as cold as an ice sculpture. "The queen is angry too," John told his uncle in a low, quiet voice. "Father took the king down to the crypts this afternoon. The queen didn't want him to go." Benjamin gave John a careful, measuring look.
"You don't miss much, do you, John? We could use a man like you on the wall."
John swelled with pride. "Rob is a stronger lance than I am, but I am the better sword, and Holland says I sit a horse as well as anyone in the castle."
"Notable achievements."
"Take me with you when you go back to the wall," John said in a sudden rush. "Father will give me leave to go if you ask him. I know he will." Uncle Benjamin studied his face carefully.
The wall is a hard place for a boy, John."
"I'm almost a man grown," John protested. "I will turn 15 on my next name day, and Maester Lewin says bastards grow up faster than other children."
"Well, that's true enough," Benjamin said with a downward twist of his mouth.
He took John's cup from the table, filled it fresh from a nearby pitcher, and drank down a long swallow. "Daeryn Targaryen was only 14 when he conquered Dorne," John said. "The young dragon was one of his heroes." "A conquest that lasted a summer," his uncle pointed out. "Your boy king lost 10,000 men taking the place. Another 50 trying to hold it. Someone should have told him that war isn't a game." He took another sip of wine. "Also," he said, wiping his mouth, "Daeryn Targaryen was only 18 when he died. Or have you forgotten that part?"
"I forget nothing," John boasted. The wine was making him bold. He tried to sit very straight to make himself seem taller. "I want to serve in the night's watch, uncle." He had thought on it long and hard, lying abed at night, while his brother slept around him. Rob would some day inherit Winterfell, would command great armies as the Warden of the North. Bran and Rickon would be Rob's bannermen and rule Holdfast in his name. His sisters, Arya and Sansa, would marry the heirs of other great houses and go south as mistress of castles of their own. But what place could a bastard hope to earn?
"You don't know what you're asking, John. The Night's Watch is a sworn brotherhood. We have no families. None of us will ever father sons. Our wife is duty. Our mistress is honour."
"A bastard can have honour too," John said. "I'm ready to swear your oath."
"You're a boy of 14, Benjamin said. "Not a man, not yet. Until you have known a woman, you cannot understand what you would be giving up."
"I don't care about that," John said hotly.
"You might, if you knew what it meant," Benjamin said. "If you knew what the oath would cost you, you might be less eager to pay the price, son."
John felt anger rise inside him.
"I am not your son."
Benjamin Stark stood up.
"More's a pity.
put a hand on John's shoulders. "Come back to me after you've fathered a few bastards of your own, and we'll see how you feel." John trembled. "I will never father a bastard," he said carefully. "Never." He spat it out like venom. Suddenly he realized that the table had fallen silent. They were all looking at him. He felt the tears begin to well behind his eyes. He pushed himself to his feet. "I must be excused," he said with the last of his dignity. He whirled and bolted before they could see him cry. He must have drunk more wine than he had realized. He got his feet tangled onto him as he tried to leave, and he lurched sideways into a serving girl and sent a flagon of spiced wine crashing to the floor. Laughter boomed all around him, and John felt hot tears on his cheeks. Someone tried to steady him. He wrenched free of their grip and ran, half blind, for the door. Ghost followed close at his heels, out into the night. The yard was quiet and empty. A lone sentry stood high on the battlements of the inner wall, his cloak pulled tight around him against the cold. He looked bored and miserable as he huddled there alone, but John would have traded places with him in an instant. Otherwise the castle was dark and deserted. John had seen an abandoned holdfast once, a drear place, where nothing moved but the wind, and the stones kept silent about whatever people had lived there. Winterfell reminded him of that tonight. The sounds of music and song spilled through the open windows behind him. They were the last things John wanted to hear. He wiped away his tears on the sleeve of his shirt, furious that he had let them fall, and started to go. "Boy!" a voice called out to him. John turned. Tyrion Lannister was sitting on the ledge above the door to the great hall, looking for all the world like a gargoyle. The dwarf grinned down at him. "Is that animal a wolf?" "A direwolf," John said. "His name is Ghost." He stared up at the little man, his disappointment suddenly forgotten. "What are you doing up there? Why aren't you at the feast?" "Too hot, too noisy, and I drunk too much wine," the dwarf told him. "I learned long ago that it's considered rude to vomit on your brother. Might I have a closer look at your wolf?"
John hesitated, then nodded slowly. "Can you climb down, or shall I bring a ladder?"
"Oh, bleed that," the little man said.
He pushed himself off the ledge into empty air.
John gasped, then watched with awe as Tyrion Lannister spun around in a tight ball, landed lightly on his hands, then vaulted backward onto his legs. Ghost backed away from him uncertainly. The dwarf dusted himself off and laughed.
"I believe I've frightened your wolf. My apologies."
"He's not scared," John said. He knelt and called out, "Ghost, come here, come on. That's it." The wolf pup padded closer and nuzzled at John's face, but he kept a wary eye on Tyrion Lannister, and when the dwarf reached out to pet him, he drew back and bared his fangs in a silent snarl.
"Shy, isn't he?"
Lannister observed. "Sit, Ghost," John commanded. "That's it, keep still." He looked up at the dwarf. "You can touch him now. He won't move until I tell him to. I've been training him."
"I see," Lannister said.
He ruffled the snow-white fur between Ghost's ears and said, "Nice wolf." "If I wasn't here, he'd tear out your throat," John said. "Wasn't actually true yet, but it would be."
"In that case, you had better stay close," the dwarf said.
He cocked his oversized head to one side and looked John over with his mismatched eyes.
"I'm Tyrion Lannister."
"I know," John said. He rose. Standing, he was taller than the dwarf. It made him feel strange.
"You're Ned Stark's bastard, aren't you?"
John felt a coldness pass right through him. He pressed his lips together and said nothing.
"Did I offend you?" Lannister said. "Sorry. Dwarfs don't have to be tactful. Generations of capering fools in Motley have won me the right to dress badly and to say any damn thing that comes into my head." He grinned. "You are the bastard, though."
"Lord Eddard Stark is my father," John admitted stiffly. Lannister studied his face.
"Yes," he said, "I can see it. You have more of the North in you than your brothers."
"Half-brothers," John corrected. He was pleased by the dwarf's comment, but he tried not to let it show.
"Let me give you some counsel, bastard," Lannister said. "Never forget what you are, for surely the world will not. Make it your strength, then it can never be your weakness. Armour yourself in it, and it will never be used to hurt you."
John was in no mood for anyone's counsel. "What do you know about being a bastard?"
"Oh, all dwarfs are bastards in their father's eyes."
"You are your mother's true-born son of Lannister."
"Am I?" the dwarf replied sardonically. "Do tell my lord father. My mother died birthing me, and he's never been sure."
"I don't even know who my mother was," John said.
"Some woman, no doubt. Most of them are." He favoured John with a rueful grin. "Remember this, boy. All dwarfs may be bastards, yet not all bastards need be dwarfs."
And with that, he turned and sauntered back into the feast, whistling a tune. When he opened the door, the light from within threw his shadow clear across the yard, and for just a moment, Tyrion Lannister stood tall as a king.
Samwell. Sam was reading about the others when he saw the mouse. His eyes were red and raw. "I ought not rub them so much," he always told himself as he rubbed them. The dust made them itch and water, and the dust was everywhere down here. Little puffs of it filled the air every time a page was turned, and it rose in grey clouds whenever he shifted a stack of books to see what might be hiding on the bottom. Sam did not know how long it had been since last he'd slept, but scarce an inch remained of the fat tallow candle he'd lit when starting on the ragged bundle of loose pages that he'd found tied up in twine. He was beastly tired, but it was hard to stop. "One more book," he had told himself, "then I'll stop. One more folio, just one more page, then I'll go up and rest and get a bite to eat." But there was always another page after that one, and another after that, and another book when waiting underneath the pile. "I'll just take a quick peek to see what this one is about," he'd think, and before he knew, he would be halfway through it. He had not eaten since that bowl of bean and bacon soup with Pip and Gren. Well, except for the bread and cheese, but that was only a nibble, he thought. That was when he took a quick glance at the empty platter and spied the mouse feasting on the breadcrumbs. The mouse was half as long as his pinky finger, with black eyes and soft grey fur. Sam knew he ought to kill it. Mice might prefer bread and cheese, but they ate paper, too. He had found plenty of mouse droppings amongst the shelves and stacks, and some of the leather covers on the books showed signs of being gnawed. It is such a little thing, though, and hungry. How could he begrudge it a few crumbs? It's eating books, though. After hours in the chair, Sam's back was stiff as a board and his legs were half asleep. He knew he was not quick enough to catch the mouse, but it might be he could squash it. By his elbow rested a massive leather-bound copy of Annals of the Black Centaur, Septon Jorquen's exhaustively detailed account of the 9 years that Orbit Caswell had served as Lord Commander of the Night's Watch. There was a page for each day of his term, every one of which seemed to begin, "Lord Orbit rose at dawn and moved his bowels," except for the last, which said, "Lord Orbit was found to have died during the night." No mouse is a match for Septon Jorquen. Very slowly, Sam took hold of the book with his left hand. It was thick and heavy, and when he tried to lift it one-handed, it slipped from his plump fingers and thumped back down. The mouse was gone in half a heartbeat, skittery quick. Sam was relieved. Squishing the poor little thing would have given him nightmares. "You shouldn't eat the books, though," he said aloud. Maybe he should bring more cheese the next time he came down here. He was surprised at how low the candle had burned. Had the bean and bacon soup been today or yesterday? Yesterday. It must have been yesterday. The realization made him yawn. John would be wondering what had become of him, though Maester Aemon would no doubt understand. Before he had lost his sight, the Maester had loved books as much as Samwell Tarly did. He understood the way that you could sometimes fall right into them, as if each page was a hole into another world. Pushing himself to his feet, Sam grimaced at the pins and needles in his calves. The chair was very hard and cut into the back of his thighs when he bent over a book. I need to remember to bring a cushion. It would be even better if he could sleep down here, in the cell he'd found, half hidden behind four chests full of loose pages that had gotten separated from the books they belonged to. But he did not want to leave Maester Aemon alone for so long. He had not been strong of late and required help, especially with the ravens. Aemon had Clydus, to be sure, but Sam was younger and better with the birds. With a stack of books and scrolls under his left arm and the candle in his right hand, Sam made his way through the tunnels the brothers called the Worm Ways. A pale shaft of light illuminated the steep stone steps that led up to the surface, so he knew that day had come up top. He left the candle burning in a wall niche and began the climb. By the fifth step he was puffing. At the tenth, he stopped to shift the books to his right arm. He emerged beneath a sky, the color of white lead. A snow sky, Sam thought, squinting up. The prospect made him uneasy. He remembered that night on the Fist of the First Men, when the whites and the snows had come together. "Don't be so craven," he thought. "You have your sworn brothers all around you, not to mention Stannis Baratheon and all his knights." Castle Black's keeps and towers rose about him, dwarfed by the icy immensity of the wall. A small army was crawling over the ice, a quarter of the way up, where a new switchback stair was creeping upward to meet the remnants of the old one. The sounds of their saws and hammers echoed off the ice. John had the builders working night and day on the task. Sam had heard some of them complaining about it over supper, insisting that Lord Mormont never worked them half so hard. Without the great stair, there was no way to reach the top of the wall, except by the chain winch, however. And as much as Samuel Tarly hated steps, he hated the winch cage more. He always closed his eyes when he was riding it, convinced that the chain was about to break. Every time the iron cage scraped against the ice, his heart stopped beating for an instant. "There were dragons here 200 years ago, Sam found himself thinking as he watched the cage making a slow descent. "They would just have flown to the top of the wall. Queen Alysanne had visited Castle Black on her dragon, and Jaehaerys, her king, had come after her on his own. Could Silverwing have left an egg behind? Or had Stannis found one egg on Dragonstone? Even if he has an egg, how can he hope to quicken it? Baelor the Blessed had prayed over his eggs, and other Targaryens had sought to hatch theirs with sorcery. All they got for it was farce and tragedy. "Samwell," said a glum voice, "I was coming to fetch you. I was told to bring you to the Lord Commander." A snowflake landed on Sam's nose. "John wants to see me." "As to that, I could not say," said Dolorous Ed Tollett. "I never wanted to see half the things I've seen, and I've never seen half the things I wanted to. I don't think wanting comes into it. You'd best go, all the same. Lord Snow wishes to speak with you as soon as he's done with Craster's wife."
"Gilly?"
"That's the one. If my wet nurse had looked like her, I'd still be on the teat. Mine had whiskers."
"Most goats do,"
called Pip, as he and Gren emerged from around the corner with longbows in hand and quivers of arrows on their backs.
"Where have you been, Slayer? We missed you last night at supper. A whole roast ox went uneaten."
"Don't call me Slayer." Sam ignored the jibe about the ox. That was just Pip. "I was reading. There was a mouse." "Don't mention mice to Gren. He's terrified of mice."
"I am not,"
Gren declared with indignation. "You'd be too scared to eat one."
"I'd eat more mice than you would."
Dolorous Ed Tollett gave a sigh. "When I was a lad, we only ate mice on special feast days. I was the youngest, so I always got the tail. There's no meat on the tail."
"Where's your longbow, Sam?" asked Gren.
Sir Alistair used to call him Aurox, and every day he seemed to grow into the name a little more. He had come to the wall big but slow, thick of neck, thick of waist, red of face, and clumsy. Though his neck still reddened when Pip twisted him around into some folly, hours of work with sword and shield had flattened his belly, hardened his arms, broadened his chest. He was strong and shaggy as an Aurox, too. Alma was expecting you at the butts.
Alma?
Sam said, abashed. Almost the first thing Jon Snow had done as Lord Commander was institute daily archery drill for the entire garrison, even stewards and cooks. The watch had been placing too much emphasis on the sword and too little on the bow, he had said, a relic of the days when one brother in every 10 had been a knight instead of one in every 100. Sam saw the sense in the decree, but he hated longbow practice almost as much as he hated climbing steps. When he wore his gloves, he could never hit anything, but when he took them off, he got blisters on his fingers. Those bows were dangerous. Satin had torn off half his thumbnail on a bowstring.
I forgot.
You broke the heart of the wildling princess, Lyra, said Pip.
Of late, Val had taken to watching them from the window of her chamber in the king's tower.
She was looking for you.
She was not. Don't say that. Sam had only spoken to Val twice when Master Aemon called upon her to make sure the babes were healthy. The princess was so pretty that he oft found himself stammering and blushing in her presence.
Why not? Asked Pip. She wants to have your children. Maybe we should call you Sam the Seducer.
Sam reddened. King Stannis had plans for Val, he knew. She was the mortar with which he meant to seal the peace between the Northmen and the Free Folk.
I don't have time for archery today. I need to go see John.
John? John? Do we know anyone named John, Grin? He means the Lord Commander.
Oh,
the great Lord Snow, to be sure.
Why do you want to see him? He can't even wiggle his ears.
Pip wiggled his to show he could. They were large ears and red from cold.
He's Lord Snow for true now, too bloody highborn for the likes of us.
John has duties, Sam said in his defence. The wall is his and all that goes with it.
A man has duties to his friends as well. If not for us, Janus Slint might be our Lord Commander. Lord Janus would have sent Snow ranging naked on a mule, scamper up onto Craster's Keep, he would have said, and fetch me back the old bear's cloak and boots.
We saved him from that, but now he has too many duties to drink a cup of mulled wine by the fire.
Gren agreed. His duties don't keep him from the yard. More days than not, he's out there fighting someone. That was true, Sam had to admit. Once, when John came to consult with Maester Aemon, Sam had asked him why he spent so much time at swordplay.
The old bear never trained much when he was Lord Commander, he had pointed out.
In answer, John had pressed Longclaw into Sam's hand. He let him feel the lightness, the balance, had him turn the blade so that ripples gleamed in the smoke-dark metal.
Valyrian steel, he said, spell-forged and razor-sharp, nigh on indestructible.
A swordsman should be as good as his sword, Sam. Longclaw is Valyrian steel, but I'm not. The half-hand could have killed me as easy as you swat a bug.
Sam handed back the sword. When I try to swat a bug, it always flies away. All I do is slap my arm. It stings.
That made John laugh. As you will. Corin could have killed me as easy as you eat a bowl of porridge. Sam was fond of porridge, especially when it was sweetened with honey.
I don't have time for this.
Sam left his friends and made his way toward the armory, clutching his books to his chest.
I am the shield that guards the realm of men, he remembered.
He wondered what those men would say if they realized their realms were being guarded by the likes of Grin, Pip, and Dolorous Ed. The Lord Commander's tower had been gutted by fire, and Stannis Baratheon had claimed the King's Tower for his own residence. So Jon Snow had established himself in Donal Noy's modest quarters behind the armory. Gilly was leaving as Sam arrived, wrapped up in the old cloak he'd given her when they were fleeing Craster's keep. She almost rushed right past him, but Sam caught her arm, spilling two books as he did.
"Gilly!" "Sam!"
Her voice sounded raw. Gilly was dark-haired and slim, with the big brown eyes of a doe. She was swallowed by the folds of Sam's old cloak, her face half hidden by its hood, but shivering all the same. Her face looked wan and frightened.
"What's wrong?"
Sam asked her. "How are the babes?" Gilly pulled loose from him.
"They're good, Sam. Good."
"Between the two of them, it's a wonder you can sleep," Sam said pleasantly. "Which one was it that I heard crying last night? I thought he'd never stop."
"Dallas, boy. He cries when he wants the teat. Mine
hardly ever cries. Sometimes he gurgles, but..." Her eyes filled with tears.
"I have to go. It's past time that I fed them. I'll be leaking all over myself if I don't go."
She rushed across the yard, leaving Sam perplexed behind her. He had to get down on his knees to gather up the books he'd dropped. "I should not have brought so many," he told himself, as he brushed the dirt off Colloquo Votar's Jade Compendium, a thick volume of tales and legends from the East that Maester Aemon had commanded him to find. The book appeared undamaged. Maester Thomax's Dragonkin being a history of House Targaryen from exile to apotheosis, with a consideration of the life and death of dragons, had not been so fortunate. It had come open as it fell, and a few pages had gotten muddy, including one with a rather nice picture of Balerion the Black Dread, done in coloured inks. Sam cursed himself for a clumsy oaf as he smoothed the pages down and brushed them off. Gilly's presence always flustered him and gave rise to, well, risings. A sworn brother of the Night's Watch should not be feeling the sorts of things that Gilly made him feel, especially when she would talk about her breasts and... "Lord Snow is waiting!" Two guards in black cloaks and iron half-helms stood by the doors of the armory, leaning on their spears. Hairy Hal was the one who'd spoken. Mully helped Sam back to his feet. He blurted out thanks and hurried past them, clutching desperately at the stack of books as he made his way past the forge with its anvil and bellows. A shirt of ringmail rested on his workbench, half completed. Ghost was stretched out beneath the anvil, gnawing on the bone of an ox to get at the marrow. The big white direwolf looked up when Sam went by, but made no sound. John Solar was back beyond the racks of spears and shields. He was reading a parchment when Sam entered, Lord Commander Mormont's raven on his shoulder, peering down as if it were reading too. But when the bird spied Sam, it spread its wings and flapped toward him, crying, "Corn! Corn!" Shifting the books, Sam thrust his arm into the sack beside the door and came out with a handful of kernels. The raven landed on his wrist and took one from his palm, pecking so hard that Sam yelped and snatched his hand back. The raven took to the air again, and yellow and red kernels went everywhere. "Close the door, Sam." Faint scars still marked John's cheek where an eagle had once tried to rip his eye out. "Did that wretch break the skin?" Sam eased the books down and peeled off his glove.
"He did." He felt faint. "I'm bleeding."
"We all shed our blood for the watch. Wear thicker gloves." John shoved a chair toward him with a foot. "Sit and have a look at this." He handed him the parchment.
"What is it?"
asked Sam. The raven began to hunt out corn kernels amongst the rushes. "A paper shield." Sam sucked at the blood on his palm as he read. He knew Maester Aemon's hand on sight. His writing was small and precise, but the old man could not see where the ink had blotted, and sometimes he left unsightly smears. "A letter to King Tommen?" "At Winterfell, Tommen fought my brother Bran with wooden swords. He wore so much padding he looked like a stuffed goose. Bran knocked him to the ground." John went to the window. "Yet Bran's dead, and pudgy pink-faced Tommen is sitting on the iron throne with a crown nestled amongst his golden curls."
"Bran's not dead," Sam wanted to say. "He's gone beyond the wall with cold hands."
The words caught in his throat.
I swore I would not tell. You haven't signed the letter.
The old bear begged the Iron Throne for help 100 times. They sent him Janus Slint. No letter will make the Lannisters love us better. Not once they hear that we've been helping Stannis.
Only to defend the wall, not in his rebellion. Sam read the letter quickly, once again. That's what it says, here. The distinction may escape Lord Tywin.
John took the letter back. Why would he help us now? He never did before.
Well, said Sam, he will not want it said that Stannis rode to the defense of the realm whilst King Tommen was playing with his toys. That would bring scorn down upon House Lannister.
It's death and destruction I want to bring down upon House Lannister, not scorn.
John lifted up the letter.
The Night's Watch takes no part in the wars of the Seven Kingdoms, he read. Our oaths are sworn to the realm, and the realm now stands in dire peril. Stannis Baratheon aids us against our foes from beyond the wall, though we are not his men.
Well, said Sam, squirming, we're not, are we?
I gave Stannis food, shelter, and the night fort, plus leave to settle some free folk in the gift. That's all.
Lord Tywin will say it was too much.
Stannis says it's not enough. The more you give a king, the more he wants. We are walking on a bridge of ice with an abyss on either side. Pleasing one king is difficult enough. Pleasing two is hardly possible.
Yes, but if the Lannisters should prevail, and Lord Tywin decides that we betrayed the king by aiding Stannis, it could mean the end of the Night's Watch. He has the Tyrells behind him with all the strength of Highgarden, and he did defeat Lord Stannis on the Blackwater.
The sight of blood might make Sam faint, but he knew how wars were won. His own father had seen to that. The Blackwater was one battle. Robb won all his battles and still lost his head. If Stannis can raise the North...
He's trying to convince himself, Sam realized, but he can't. The ravens had gone forth from Castle Black in a storm of black wings, summoning the lords of the North to declare for Stannis Baratheon and join their strength to his. Sam had sent out most of them himself. Thus far only one bird had returned, the one they'd sent to Carhold. Elsewise the silence had been thunderous. Even if he should somehow win the Northmen to his side, Sam did not see how Stannis could hope to match the combined powers of Casterly Rock, Highgarden, and the Twins. Yet without the North, his cause was surely doomed. As doomed as the Night's Watch, if Lord Tywin marks us down as traitors. The Lannisters have Northmen of their own, Lord Bolton and his bastard. Stannis has the Karstarks. If he can win White Harbor, if, Sam stressed, if not, my lord, even a paper shield is better than none.
John rattled the letter. I suppose so. He sighed, then took up a quill and scrawled a signature across the bottom of the letter. Get the sealing wax. Sam heated a stick of black wax over a candle and dribbled some onto the parchment, then watched as John pressed the Lord Commander's seal down firmly on the puddle.
"Take this to Maester Aemon when you leave," he commanded, "and tell him to dispatch a bird to King's Landing."
"I will." Sam hesitated. "My lord, if I might ask, I saw Gilly leaving. She was almost crying."
"Val sent her to plead for Mance again."
"Oh."
Val was the sister of the woman the king beyond the wall had taken for his queen. The wildling princess was what Stannis and his men were calling her. Her sister Dalla had died during the battle, though no blade had ever touched her. She had perished giving birth to Mance Raider's son. Raider himself would soon follow her to the grave, if the whispers Sam had heard had any truth to them.
What did you tell her?
That I would speak to Stannis. Though I doubt my words will sway him. A king's first duty is to defend the realm, and Mance attacked it. His grace is not like to forget that. My father used to say that Stannis Baratheon was a just man. No one has ever said he was forgiving.
John paused, frowning. I would sooner take off Mansi's head myself. He was a man of the night's watch once. By rights, his life belongs to us. Pip says that Lady Melisandre means to give him to the flames, to work some sorcery. Pip should learn to hold his tongue. I have heard the same from others. King's blood, to wake a dragon.